Last time we got through the 47th chapter of Isaiah, so tonight we're going to begin with the 48th chapter of Isaiah, and we'd like to just cover this one chapter tonight, which is 22 verses long. This chapter is another prophecy in which God is assuring Israel of their deliverance from Babylon. He names in here some of the causes of the captivity, some of the reasons why it was necessary for them to be put into bondage, and there are lamentations because of it. But it is just an assurance then of God's love that they will be redeemed from their captivity. This is written, you might say, to the exiled Jews, but there are certain parts of it that seem to be written to have an influence upon the Jews before they were taken into captivity, written maybe as a warning, as something that they could take into their own lives, and if they could bring about a change, then it would put them in better favor with God. And this first verse is, some of it is really a kind of a difficult verse. It is, at least for me, to try to give a good explanation of. He says, "Hear ye this, O house of Jacob, which are called by the name of Israel, and are come forth out of the waters of Judah." Now this is just, of course, getting their attention. "Hear ye this." And then he calls them, "O house of Jacob." Well, that's easy to understand why he would call them the house of Jacob, because they were the descendants of Jacob. You know, Isaac had Jacob and Esau, and Jacob was the one who had the birthright, and then Jacob had the 12 sons, and then this land of Israel then were descendants of Jacob. So he says, "O house of Jacob, who are called by the name of Israel." Now, Israel was another name that was given to Jacob. When he wrestled with the angel, then he was given the name Israel, and this name Israel means a soldier of God. So they're also called by the name of Israel. Then he says, "Which are come forth out of the waters of Judah." Now Judah was one of the 12 tribes, you remember, the tribe that predominated in the kingdom of the south, that is the kingdom of Judea. And the tribe of Judah, of course, was located in the region of Jerusalem and Judea, and so these people who were taken into captivity actually were primarily descendants from Judah. Judah was the center and main tribe of that area where they were. As you know, the 10 tribes to the north had been taken into captivity many years before, and they were properly known as Israel, but these people now in the south were really from Judah, from the tribe of Judah and from the kingdom of Judah. And so he says, "You're come forth out of the waters of Judah," which means that Judah then would be like a fountain, and the waters that flowed out of Judah were then where these people had originated, who were now in captivity and that God was going to deliver. And so now he further describes them by saying, "Which swear by the name of the Lord and make mention of the God of Israel, but not in truth nor in righteousness." Now, "which swear by the name of the Lord," what would mean that they recognized the name of the Lord. And there were certain provisions in the law whereby a person could swear. He could call upon the name of the Lord. And it was according to God's law for it to be done. It wasn't using his name in vain in any sense of the term. It was a very reverential, awesome manner of calling upon God as a witness or as a record. But he says, "You swear by the name of the Lord, but it's not in truth nor in righteousness." That is, they were doing it without a full realization or a full feeling as to the true nature and greatness of God. So they really then, in their swearing by the name of the Lord, would have been taking the Lord's name in vain. And then he says, "And make mention of the God of Israel." That is, they prayed to him and they worshipped him. They went through the motions. They called upon his name. They made mention of him. But he said, "It's not in truth nor in righteousness." And so we learn a great lesson from this, that it's possible for a people or for a person or for a group to give every appearance of being a righteous person, to seem to call upon God's name, to seem to worship God and serve God, but yet it's not really in truth that you're doing it, and it's not really in righteousness that you're doing it. In other words, just to call upon God's name, just to go through some rituals or some motions of serving God, but if it's not according to the truth, then that is of no value to you. It's not going to do you any good if it's not according to the truth. Israel had a lot of things that were truth, but they also had many things in their practices that were not according to truth. They were living a kind of a life that was not a righteous life. They were incorporating many of the features of idolatry in their practices. And so here he chides them. He ridicules them for the fact that they claimed to be of God. They called upon his name, but it wasn't in truth nor in righteousness. Verse 2. For, and this word for means although, although or for they call themselves of the holy city and stay themselves upon the God of Israel, the Lord of hosts is his name. Now they call themselves of the holy city. That is, they profess to be holy and godly people, but they were really following idolatry. They claimed to be members of the family of God. They made a great ado over the fact that they were from the city of Jerusalem and that they centered their worship in Jerusalem. They called themselves of the holy city. And of course we see then today that there are multitudes of people who can claim to be of the church, members of the church, associated with the church in some way. And then he says, and stay themselves upon the God of Israel. To stay means to rest or to lean or to use God for your support. They use God to support themselves. They lean upon him. They claim that he is their protector. And so he's, you know, even though that they're not in truth, even though they're not in righteousness, they still claim to be God-fearing people, and they profess to be people that are holy and righteous. So we can begin to see as we have these people described to us who were so unpleasing with God, so displeasing to God that he had them hauled into captivity, we can begin to see as we see their description how those around us today can also fit that same description and how we can allow ourselves, if we're not careful, to get into the rut of claiming to be a follower of God and professing to be a follower of God when in reality what we're doing is not in truth and it's not in righteousness. So he says, they stay themselves upon the God of Israel. The Lord of hosts is his name. Now, they leaned upon him. They depended upon him. And no doubt they made long and devout and arduous prayers to God to help them and to protect them and to guide them. But simply because they were not in truth and because they were not in righteousness, this was of very little avail. For this same God utterly destroyed their nation and their national heritage and had them uprooted from their homes and cities and taken into captivity. The Lord of hosts is his name. It seems that Isaiah here, when he's talking about their relationship to God and their looking to God, that he really emphasizes and places a strong amount of focus upon the fact that this really was the true God that they were slighting. This was the living and holy God that they were pretending to worship when really they weren't worshiping him. And so he calls him the Lord of hosts. Now, the word hosts here means all of the heavenly bodies. And so he is the Lord of all the heavenly bodies, the stars, the planets, the sun, the moon, all of these bodies. He is the Lord of all of them. And this is a way of emphasizing then the fact that he is the one God and the true God and the living God. No idol made of stick or stone or molded or cast in any way, no idol could even begin to remotely scratch the surface of the effect and power that the true and living God has in that he is the Lord of hosts. In verse 3, I have declared the former things from the beginning. Now here God is making a reference to his prophecies and pointing out to the people the prophecies that he'd given and how important and accurate they were and how supernatural it was to be able to do this. To have declared the former things means that he declared a series of events from the beginning down to the time that they were completely fulfilled. He told the sequence in which they would happen, and he declared them in the order of their fulfillment. He says, "And they went forth out of my mouth, and I showed them. I did them suddenly, and they came to pass." God declared these things. He said, "They went forth out of my mouth," so that it was made known. It wasn't something that was just kept in secret, and after it all happened, then he revealed that he had known it beforehand. But this went forth before that it happened, and I showed them. In other words, God showed what was going to happen. He clearly demonstrated the events of the future by his prophecies. And then he said, "I did them suddenly, and they came to pass." That is, these prophecies were fulfilled whenever man least expected it to happen. He wasn't just really expecting it to happen at the time it happened, because he gave very little value or thought to God's prophecies. And yet, whenever it was time for it to happen, he said, "I did them suddenly, and they came to pass." These prophecies came to pass surely, swiftly, and suddenly. And as we look back on the events today, events that he prophesied hundreds of years before that it would happen, as we look back on those events today, we see that truly, when the time came, while the events fell right into place, it happened. It happened over a short period of time, and it did all come to pass. And this is a strong lesson to us today as we stop and think of the prophecies that God has yet given that have not yet come to pass. We know that in the future that Christ is going to come again. We're going to be resurrected from the graves. There is going to be a judgment day, and this earth is going to be melted with an intense heat. All the elements are going to be dissolved, and everything's going to be changed, and our bodies are going to be changed. Now, those are definite, hard and fast prophecies that this same God has made. This same God who called things in the order of their events, who called them hundreds of years before they transpire and told them exactly as they would. And then he says, "I did them suddenly, and they came to pass." In verse 4, he begins to tell why he felt it necessary to give these prophecies, why he had to make such predictions to prove his existence, and also why that he had to carry them into captivity as a form of punishment to purge them. He says, "Because I knew that thou art obstinate, and thy neck is an iron sinew, and thy brow brass." Now, he knew the nature of this people. He knew that they were a people who were not to be trusted. They were hard, and so he had to deal with them accordingly. "I knew that thou art obstinate." The word obstinate means hard or rebellious. Now, ordinarily, when we think of hard or rebellious, we think primarily, first of all, the heart becoming hard. Now, to have a hard heart, it means simply then that you don't have any feeling for certain things. You lose your ability for things to have an effect upon you. We read in the New Testament of where the Gentiles have their conscience seared. They're beyond feeling. Those that teach false doctrine, he says, have their conscience seared with a hot iron. When you sear something with a hot iron, then after a while, it feels the searing all right, but then after a while it becomes calloused, and it has scar tissue that grow over it, and it no longer has the feeling that it used to have. It loses its feeling. And so one of the most important things that we can have in this life is our ability to continue to have a feeling about what's right and what's wrong. When we do something that's wrong, if we have cultivated the ability not to feel anything wrong there, not to feel any sense of shame or wrongdoing, then we are in that position of being obstinate or hard. Now, you know, you can take just about any act that you know of that is wrong And the one I like to use most is would be the act of letting yourself be seen without any clothes on, to appear in a naked state. The average person, if he was suddenly told just to pull off his clothes and walk down Main Street, would feel such a sense of shame, of guilt, of uneasiness about it, that he would not want to do it, and it would have to be forced upon him to do it. But if this person gradually began to take off clothes and gradually appeared in public, and so that less and less and less was worn, after a while they would become so hardened to the fact that it would no longer have any effect on them. And they could appear right down on Main Street in a bikini bathing suit or even less, and it wouldn't bother them at all, simply due to this process of hardening their heart or their conscience. Well, this is what Israel had happened to them. He said, I knew that thou art obstinate, that is, hard or rebellious. Now, if we can learn then that this characteristic is most displeasing to God, and that this characteristic is one of the first steps towards losing the complete favor of God, then it's a warning to us. And we should not allow it to happen to us, nor should we fall into the rut or the tradition or the social order of the day in which it happens to others. Let us keep our sense of what's right and wrong, our sense of decency and honesty and morality. Let us keep that sharply honed so that we then are able to feel the slightest little nick of shame or guilt in any wrongdoing that we might do. And he further says, and thy neck is an iron sinew. Now this is taken from the figure of oxen who would have the yoke put on them. And whenever their neck became an iron sinew, the word sinew here means some kind of a connective tissue in the formation of the body, or a muscle. And when their neck became so that it had an iron sinew, then it would refuse to submit to the yoke. The yoke wouldn't have any effect on it. It would not let the yoke guide it or limit it in its actions. Then the third thing he says is, and thy brow brass. And this this idea of having a brass brow refers to the shameless brow of a harlot. That's the figure that's used here. The shameless brow of the harlot. A harlot that has no expression in her face, feeling of shame or guilt of wrongdoing, who has a kind of a haughty attitude, who can throw out a look of contempt for all that's good and right. This then was known as having the brow that was like brass. And so this is the way he describes his people. I knew that you're obstinate, and thy neck is an iron sinew, and thy brow is brass. And so this was the reason why then that they were given this punishment, and that God felt that he had to prophesy about it and bring its fulfillment about it to prove to these people beyond any shadow of a doubt that he was the true God and that he would not tolerate idolatry. And as we look around about us today and see all of the many, many forms of idolatry that are still in existence, even more rampant than ever in the apostate church, this should make us shudder and take a strong inclination to want to do what God says. Because we can see today where the so-called religious people are hard. They are obstinate. They do have an iron sinew for a neck. They do have the brass brow because they will not submit to the things that are so clearly taught by God. Verse 5, I have even from the beginning declared it to thee. Before it came to pass, I showed it to thee. Lest thou shouldest say, mine idol hath done them, and mine graven image, and mine molten image hath commanded them. So God demonstrates here that through the fulfilling of his prophecy, that he is the only God, the only true and living God. And he says, I did it because of this reason. Even from the beginning I declared it unto thee. Before it came to pass, I showed it to you. In other words, I declared it, and before it ever happened, I showed you what was going to happen, so that you could not say, mine idol hath done them, and mine graven image, and mine molten image hath commanded them. These people, in other words, were so far gone into idolatry that if God hadn't made this so plain and so realistic and so beyond any shadow of a doubt, they then would have been saying, well, my idol did this. My molten image did this, or my graven image did this, had commanded this to happen. And they would have not given the credit to the true God. Now, you know, we can see that today. Today, people are ever so prone, ever so apt to want to ascribe powers to other beings, to other powers other than the true and living God. We're living in a society that is so superstitious. You can open up the paper and read what they say the stars are supposed to say, or the horoscope is supposed to say about you for this particular day. Everybody's got their own horoscope, and it's all written out there. I don't know where they got all this information from, but anyway, this is a bunch of really hocus pocus. And this is about the same thing as saying, well, my idol says this, or my God, my image, my fictitious power or source of information has predicted so-and-so. And God has said that this very thing would have happened about these events if he hadn't clearly demonstrated to his people that they came from him. Today we have people who pray to saints. They pray to angels. They pray to the so-called Virgin Mary. And they go through all kinds of gyrations to attribute things to a God, a source of power that never was intended to be. We do not pray to angels. We do not pray to other saints. We don't go through another man or have man go to God for us in our place. This is not God's way at all. So he says, if I hadn't done this, you'd say, my idol had done it, and my image hath commanded it. So in verse 6, thou hast heard, see all this, and will not ye declare it? In other words, he says, you've heard my prophecies now. You have seen the fulfillment of it, and now will you not declare it? In other words, since you are my witnesses, you of all people do know that these things are true and that I am the living God, won't you go out and declare it? Won't you stand up for me, for my way, for my rights? So that I then can have at least somebody who is on my side, somebody who is proclaiming my way. And I think that it's very easy for us to learn from this little sentence here in verse 6 that God really intends for all of his people, all of his faithful followers then, to become those who will declare his will, those who will declare that he is the true and the living God, who will stand up for him and who will be his friend. You know, in this life, if you have somebody who is a close friend, and you're sitting around, say, in a group of persons who are carrying on a conversation, and somebody begins to malign your friend. Say they start saying something false about your friend, or they start running the name down, or they start some kind of a nasty rumor. If you're really true and faithful to your friend, you're gonna check them. You're going to say, look here, that's not true. That's false. That's a lie. You're just quoting something that doesn't even apply to the situation. You're wrong. In other words, you stand up for your friend and for the honor of your friend. Well, do we have that same feeling, and do we stand up for God the same way that we would for another friend? If we hear somebody using God's name in vain, does it bother us? Does it bother for somebody just to come around with all kinds of cussing? Does it make us want to rise up and tell that person, look here, you clean up your mouth now and you watch who you're talking about. You're talking about God now. You know, we don't allow that in any place where I have any kind of authority or influence. Or do we just sit back meekly and kind of laugh and go along with the filthy conversation? He says, declare it. Will not you declare it? Won't we just tell people? Won't we just repeat what we know about God? I have showed thee new things from this time, even hidden things, and thou didst not know them. Now the new thing that he's talking about here means that in all of the prophecies that God has given, during this particular age here now, he showed them something that was new. You know, prophecies about the Messiah and about the kingdom, they have been given ever since the book of Genesis. We've had some prophecies that have been all through the Bible. But here now he puts something new in at this area. Something new, he says, even hidden things, which thou didst not know them, And he's talking about this new thing being the deliverance from the captivity. The fact that they were going to be put into captivity and then delivered from it and brought back to their land. That was the new thing he was now showing. Verse 7. They are created now and not from the beginning. Even before the day when thou heardest them, not. Lest thou shouldest say, behold, I knew them. So he said that they're created now and not from the beginning. That is, I'm just now making these things known. I'm just now putting these things into fashion, into creation. In other words, when God says something, if we could just get this in our mind, it would give us a lot more respect for God. When God says something is going to happen, in effect, he has just created it. It's created just as surely as we're created. And it's going to happen. And so he says they are created now and not from the beginning. These things didn't even exist before, not even in prophecy. Just now become God's plan for it to happen, evidently. They're just now put into existence. Even before the day when thou heardest them not. And that probably should be worded these were created even before the day that you heard them, when you hadn't heard them before then. Lest thou shouldest say, behold, I knew them. I'm just now letting this be known. I've just now created it so that you would not have the opportunity to say that I already knew about it. I fixed it so that there'd be no way that you could have possibly known about this before it came to pass, or before I told it, before I predicted it, so that you couldn't say, behold, I knew them. And this also is so that man could not attribute these things to happening just simply out of chance, or to say that natural causes brought them to pass. Nobody could say that, because when God did create them and when he did make them known, then the fulfillment of them was so spectacular and so perfectly in accord with the sequence of events that he laid out that it could not have been a happenstance nor by natural causes. Now in verse 8, yea, thou heardest not, yea, thou knewest not, yea, from that time that thine ear was not opened. Now, I think what he's saying in this verse is that sure, it's true that back before I gave these things, back before I created these things, sure it is true. You didn't know about them. You didn't hear about them. You had no opportunity to know. Thou heardest not, thou knewest not, yea, from that time thine ear was not opened. For I knew that thou wouldest deal very treacherously and was called a transgressor from the womb. Here is the reason that God was so careful to hide his word before he was ready for it to come out. Here's the reason that God absolutely kept them in the dark about what was going to happen before he was ready to make his prophecy known unto them. It was because he said, I knew that thou wouldest deal very treacherously and was called a transgressor from the womb. Now what does he mean here? I knew that thou wouldest deal very treacherously. He means that he knew by the very nature of this people and by their previous actions that they would handle his word in a very treacherous manner. They would not guard it and protect it and preserve it and teach it as it should be, but they would take it and pervert it and distort it so that they then would be attributing God's word to these idols. And that's what he just said back up in the previous verse. Lest thou shouldest say, mine idol hath done them, and my graven image and my molten image hath commanded them. So God is very careful about how he gives his word out when he knows that it's a tendency on the part of that person or on the part of that group of persons to deal treacherously with his word. And so you can see right here one of the basic reasons behind why man is so ignorant of God's word. It's because God does not let his word out to man when he knows that man is going to deal treacherously with his word. And this falls right back to that great principle that's taught in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 10 or so, in which he says, if you do not have a love for the truth, I will send you a strong delusion that you should believe a lie. God doesn't give his word out so that you can kick it around and deal contentiously with it and twist it around and distort it. He'll not let you have his word to do that with. Otherwise, you're going to have to be content then with believing a strong delusion, a strong lie, a strong false belief. And God's going to send it for you. Oh, it may look like it comes out of the pages of the Bible, all right, but it's still a strong, false belief. And everybody knows that anybody can take the Bible and twist it around and make it teach anything they want to teach us, but taking it out of its context. And so he says here that he didn't let them hear it, and he didn't let them know it, because I knew thou would deal very treacherously. You think God is just begging you to take his word? He just groveled.